So welcome everyone to our course, Glossovino in Pittsburgh. Just a real quick show of hands first. If any of you have taken my classes in the past, okay, excellent. So for those that haven't, my name is Matthew Schlue. I'm a registered architect. I've been practicing for about 2 decades. Still practicing. I was at a couple job sites this morning running around, but I've been teaching here at CMU a little over a year now, I think, but also I've been teaching in the Pitt OSHA program as well for a number of years. So just want to thank you for signing up for the class, and if you have any kind of comments, feedback, suggestions, I'm all ears, because this is primarily for your benefit, so I want to try to make the class as useful as possible. But to be honest, I actually think I get more out of this class than you guys probably get. So I really enjoy presenting the material. It really, working through it and preparing for the material just really kind of keeps me on my toes with my practice. So and a lot of this stuff kind of filters into my work, which is always nice. So the last class that some of you might have taken with me was on Antonio Gaudí from Barcelona. This class will kind of follow along that same kind of tradition as far as the Catalan style architecture. Glossovino was kind of Gaudí's senior. He was about a half generation earlier than Gaudí. And so you'll see some similarities in the work, and also there's some other parallels that we'll get into as well. But if you enjoy the Gaudí class, I think you'll definitely enjoy this, especially since there's the ties to Pittsburgh, which is really what we're going to be focusing on through the course. So before getting into Raphael, I wanted to kind of set a little bit of stage for the context that we're working here. Not so much related to Glossovino and the Catalan architecture, but more architecture generally. And so with that, this is a site in eastern Ohio. It's just not too far from here. I visited the site about 2 months ago for the first time. But these are earthworks, the mound builders. I don't know if you're familiar with them or not, but they're from about 2,000 years ago. It used to be all along the Mississippi and Ohio River before the Europeans got here. The natives created these mounds, earthworks, where they mounded up in this case, in different type shapes, enclosures, but also most of the time it was just simply a mound, not necessarily in a figure or a shape or geometric like this, or what they call an effigy mound, like a snake or something, or a lizard. But these things kind of, even today with the archaeologists, still remain a little bit of a mystery as to who made them, why they made them. And so growing up, I grew up in central Ohio, and these things were kind of all through the Ohio Valley. And growing up as a grade schooler, we learned about them in grade school as kind of like Ohio history. And it was always kind of like a mystery that intrigued me as a kid, you know, like wondering, you know, where did these things come from? And we actually took a field trip to visit one of them at one point in school. But this one in particular, the Great Circle Mound, I wanted to highlight here today. This is an aerial shot. You can see the mound here. It circles with an opening into the space. They now have a museum there that you can actually go visit. But this is in right in the middle of Newark, Ohio. If you're familiar with Newark, Newark's not a very large city, but You can see the housing right up against it. Over here, there's a major thoroughfare that has commercial, industrial space. So it's like right down the middle, which is also kind of a thing with these mounds, is that as kind of development and things kind of build up, they kind of destroyed many of these. A lot of them early on, two centuries ago, with farming. As farming came in, since that takes up quite a bit of area, they would plow fields and they kind of level these mounds. But in any event, so this Great Circle Mound, not only the Great Circle Mound, but the last slide I showed you here, this complex of these geometries is the largest geometric earthwork in the world as far as size. You could fit within this circle here, you could fit the Giza Pyramid. And then this this octagon field here, you could fit four Acropolis temples. So it's quite massive. But what the enclosure that we're seeing here, the mound that circles this, that creates this great circle, ranges in height from anywhere from 8 to 14 feet. So it's not a huge elevation change. You can see here kind of on the outside of it, approaching it. And then this is the at the entry, that entry point from the outside kind of looking in. You can see where the mounds kind of on the sides break to let for this passage, and then you can see the that kind of circle kind of continuing around. It's a quite large area, and in the center of the space has actually got a little bit of a raised mound as well. But what's interesting is as you pass through this entry point, there's a distinct or palpable sense that you are passing through some type of a threshold, that you're entering into this space. Even though that space is quite subtle, quite large, you know, it's just a passage. But as you enter into this space, you feel like you definitely feel the sense of enclosure. And that's really why I wanted to kind of point this out, because at its essence, architecture is more about kind of how space makes you feel, more so than maybe something that makes you think or for some other functional purpose. You can see here actually with this slide, you can see how these mounds were actually created. They excavated out this earth and kind of mounded it up along the side, and that kind of goes around this perimeter. And then as you work your way inside, you can see how this entire enclosure, it creates this sense of inside and outside, just with the simple gesture of mounting up some earth. And then this is, once you're inside, kind of looking back at the entry point here, you can see the museum that's just beyond the entry point. And so then you get this sense of enclosure. And part of that also is because the mound height is above eye level, where it ranges from 8 to 14 feet. So you can't see beyond, like you can see here, where you can see off into the distance. There's no kind of impediment to that vision. The mound kind of creates that, and so then that really is what defines this sense of enclosure that you're experiencing. Despite the fact it's completely open to the sky above you, it's not like you're underneath a structure. And so this is partly why I knew of this earthwork for many years, studied it, and there's quite a few books that are written about it. Never had visited in person, but like most architecture that we'll be talking about here over the next couple weeks, without kind of being there in person and experiencing it, you don't get that palpable sense of sensation that you feel when you're in a space that you can not necessarily interpret through a photograph or a video. And that's really kind of what makes architecture interesting in that regard, because it's something that's experienced as opposed to more of just a cerebral. And that brings us to a place that you might be familiar with, Heinz Hall, with the Pittsburgh Symphony. Just last week, I was there taking in Mahler, First Symphony, and there was a something I bring this in because there's something that Monfort Honeck, the music conductor, has said to his musicians about it's a little tongue in cheek, but he defines music as falling in one of two camps. It's either a polka or it's a waltz. And so, you know, it kind of speaks to this idea that, you know, the difference between a polka and a waltz is basically, you know, tempo and, but also kind of the energy of the piece. You know, one is very active and one's kind of more a softer kind of inactive type piece. And so that kind of distinction, whenever he's working on any type of piece, you know, that's the kind of energy that he references. That piece either falls into one of those two camps in his mind. You know, this, or even the piece might change through the piece. You know, there's parts that are very active and lively, and other parts that are more subdued and kind of soft. And so there's, you know, that changes through a composition. But as he's kind of working through those various parts with his musicians, he's trying to express in some way this energy that the piece of music has. And that's kind of his shorthand for that. And so along those same kind of lines, I kind of define architecture falls into two camps as well. Like you can divide it up. And that is what we just looked at, which is the earth mounds, which are this walled enclosure. And then you also have a roof. And those two elements, the roof and the walls, go back to the very beginning of when shelter was created, that really kind of defined a space outside of or inside of the external environment. And so this idea that up until recently, architecture generally is kind of broken down into those two elements. You have vertical walls and you have horizontal roof or ceilings. And so this earth mound that we just looked at is an example of that wall. By contrast, Guastavino, what makes him interesting is that a lot of his vaults obviously are overhead, so they're this kind of roof condition. But what you're going to see over the next couple weeks is how he's trying to kind of blur those edges between the two. He's trying to bring his vaults down into become not only a roof condition but also walls that where you can't really define, okay, you know, that's a wall or that's a roof. It's kind of somewhere in between, and that's by intention. Since we're on the topic of Heinz, I thought I'd take, while I was there, I took a shot of the ceiling, and you can see kind of like this, the vaulted space over the ceiling at Heinz. And what's interesting is you can see this kind of relief that they put in the center of the ceiling, where they have lights that are kind of up inside there. They also have mechanical equipment that's feeding kind of like air, conditioned air down into the space. This more practical side of architecture that you get into, in addition to what we've just been speaking about, all of that also is necessary in what an architect needs to think about. One little side point here, I'll mention it, which I find interesting, is that. When I go to the symphony, my favorite spot to sit is in the very top back row in the center, because you get acoustically, you get the best sound, I think, as far as carrying from the stage. And it's interesting because acoustics is obviously something that architects take into account, especially if they're designing a theater. And actually, we're going to get into one of Guastavino's theaters here today, which is why I kind of brought this into a local theater here. But acoustically, it's all about trying to get, you know, the sounds they're creating, you know, to your ears. And the way that the stage is set up is all about radiating that sound out, bringing it to you. This particular photograph I took last weekend, I was sitting, you can see here, I was in the balcony down near the front on the right-hand side of the stage a little bit. And it was closer than I usually sit, I could see the musicians better, but I noticed, it was perceivable, I noticed that the sound was not anything as good as what you get at the very top row in the back. And what's even also, I like doing when I'm at symphonies, like closing your eyes and like trying to listen to a particular instrument. And then when you listen to it, like turn your head so that way you're, you know, angling your ears to like be focused right on that one instrument. And then open your eyes and see if in fact you're looking right at the person that's creating that sound. And you know, you can do that, it's kind of like a tuning type thing. You can do that, you know, where you can, you know, you can tune in on this bass and hear by, you know, and then close your eyes and then tune in on like a violin over here. But what's interesting is that this half of the orchestra is sitting with their instruments facing away from you. They're, you know, their F-holes that are coming out of their instruments are pointing away, whereas this half of the orchestra is pointing towards you. And most of the sound is coming out of the face of the instrument, on the strings anyways. And so when you close your ears, you know, you're hearing most everything coming from your left side, more so than the right. And so like to get that kind of balanced sound, which I think is kind of the intent of the orchestra, is to blend it all together. It seems kind of odd to me that this half is kind of positioned in that way. It's been done that way historically, so nobody questions it. But you'd almost like a scenario where you kind of get left-handed and right-handed people and position them so that way just a thought as an architect, but I'm not a... So, I also, before we get into Gluskin, I wanted to take one other little side tangent here on Richard Serra, who's an artist, sculptor, that is one of my favorites, because he, in his work, being sculpture, he deals with a lot of architectural kind of ideas in his work, which fascinates me. This is a particular piece called Snake Eyes and Boxcars. And they're installing these two cubes that are solid carbon steel blocks that are in dimension wise here, they're 41 inches square and they range from 48 inches tall to 84 inches tall. But what's interesting about these is that he's using these, he's putting these in pairs in this landscape where he's installing these pieces. He's got a series of about 8 of these pairings through the landscape. And he's doing this to define a point in the landscape by pairing these together to where they become like a threshold. You know, they become a passage. You can actually see a footpath here that's kind of cleared from, you know, coming from this one down to this one. And so you can kind of work your way through the landscape, passing through each one of these. And as you pass through them, they frame a view or take on a certain vantage point. But it's interesting because he also, the way they're set up, and you can see this here, like, you know, this sweeping landscape, how this kind of defines a space within that landscape. It marks a point, it creates a threshold that, you know, if you were to walk between these as opposed to walk around them, you would definitely perceive, you know, that kind of feeling as you walk between them, that you're kind of passing through something. And that's, you know, it's a subtle thing, but that's, you know, those thresholds, those kind of feelings is what architecture is all about. He's kind of doing some of that with his sculpture here. But what's fascinating about his piece is that he's got two different sizes and he has the top aligned to the same elevation. And so how far apart these pieces are is based on what the contour of the grade is. If the ground was not as steep and it was shallower, then this piece would have to move further away to keep the tops kind of aligned. And it's fascinating because this top alignment is artificial. It's in nature, you get these very irregular kind of contours in the ground. You don't have these really hard, sharp, straight lines, orthogonal lines for certain. You know, nature grows in a very organic way, but this artificial elevation point he's creating is really the heart of his piece, because what that does is it accentuates this line, which is a more natural line. because by making this such a firm thing that stands in contrast to everything around it, immediately you draws your eye to it because it's so foreign to this natural environment, that then by extension accentuates the natural line. And so here he's introducing this human-made form into this natural setting, which is what architecture also, again, is all about. It's taking the natural environment, creating a human-made structure that we can occupy, get inside of, take shelter within, this type of thing. Yes.
Where is this located?
This particular one is in, this is in California, Gayersville, California. He actually has, he made these pieces up in Seattle. And when he trucked them from Seattle to California, this is a private residence, the lot that it's sited on. But the pieces, because the pieces are solid steel, not only are they solid, but he hammered them to like really make them dense, compress them. And the pieces all totaled, there's 8 pairs or 6 pairs, it was like 250 tons of weight. To the point where when they put them on the trucks, it was like a convoy of trucks because they could only put so many on a truck to stay within the weight limit on the roads. So it was a major ordeal just getting it from Seattle to this site. But yeah, I believe it's in Northern California. It's a place called Gayersville, California. This was in 1990. And so you see, just to kind of go back to the mounds, we see the same type thing. Looking at this, we immediately recognize these earthworks as foreign, that they're not something naturally made. This has been done by human hand. And so we immediately recognize that because it's not something, even though the material is very natural material, it's just earth, clay, the texture and the surface is the same material that you're finding over here, but by this physical change to the environment, we're seeing something that we immediately recognize as foreign to the environment, much the same way that we recognize this steel is also foreign to the natural environment. Here's another piece by Sarah, it's called Shift. Here he's gone from the cubes to a wall, a linear piece. And then I threw this in here. This is one of my own projects that I'm working on up in Mars, PA right now, a house that we're building. And we just recently finished the foundation walls that you're seeing here the house will be built on top of this. But I put these in here because it's interesting that Richard Serra has this thing where he gets into discussions with architects as a sculptor. One of his favorite architects that he works with is Frank Gehry, you may know of. And the two of them dispute or discuss the difference between art and architecture. Serra, being a sculptor, is very, has a lot of ties to architecture more so than some of the other arts. But he makes a very clear distinction between the two, saying that, in fact, let me get his quote here. He has this last piece here that I showed, Shift, was made of concrete. And instead of these steel cubes, he was making these long linear elements that would then snake through the valley. Because it was these long linear things, he poured these in concrete. And these are only one of two pieces in his entire career that he's done in concrete. And the reason why is because after he did this piece, he said that concrete was too architectural for sculpture. And so just the material in making these walls, a lot of people, when they saw his work, they mistake this for being remnants of a foundation from a building that used to be on site. And so just that kind of implication has this very strong tie to architectural buildings, less so or more so than this. You know, people aren't thinking, oh, this is some remnant from some former building that used to be there, whereas this does. And so along those lines, this clearly you can see this as some kind of a structure that you might infer as a building. But then as you change your perspective to where you bring your eye level to in line with the top, as opposed to looking across it, it changes from a three-dimensional form to a two-dimensional form. And when it changes to this two-dimensional form, it becomes more, again, more like a wall. It's not this three-dimensional object that's a foundation for a house. This now just becomes a physical wall that kind of blocks your view of this this horizon, of this landscape. So it, in this regard, it becomes a little bit more like sculpture or art than architecture as compared to this.
Would that be considered brutal or a cousin of brutal, like the Lean Building or WQED?
Yes. So like the brutalist style that you're referring to, a large part of that was kind of this use of concrete materials as a, not only as a construction, but also as a finished material. Definitely has those brutal aspects to it. Now once this is done, this concrete won't be exposed. But if you were to kind of use this as a finished material, it would definitely take on that kind of brutal aspect. And also we're going to see that in Los Tovinos' work as we go forward. We're going to see that that's actually one of the key distinctions between his work here in Pittsburgh and back in Europe that we're looking at here today, is this kind of leaving the clay tiles exposed as opposed to as more just as a structural element back in Valencia and Barcelona. Some of you might be familiar with Marcel Duchamp's fountain, where he took a urinal and he used it in a, such a way of, as a found object. It became a piece of art by signing his name to it and positioning it in a context that's outside of its usual context, which is this, which is more of a functional element for a bathroom setting as opposed to a gallery setting. And so again, we have this distinction between what's considered art and then what's kind of the architectural realm, you know, where you have drawings, elevations, dimensions, taking this element and seeing it as a functional item. And that's, you know, in shorthand, that's the way a lot of artists will define the difference between the two, is that architecture is functional, whereas art not necessarily is functional in that regard. I would take it a little bit further that architecture actually includes art, but it also includes some things in addition to art, such as function or some many other things that we're going to get into here today. So that brings us to Raphael. We're seeing here, second from the left here on the in the front row. He was born in Valencia in 1842 into a large family of 13 brothers and sisters. His family was very industrious, crafty, there were a lot of musicians. The children all learned to play music. In fact, Raphael started out playing the violin and was intending to become a professional musician before he got into the building arts. And I point that out because it's interesting that with a violin, if you're an accomplished violinist, is that speaks a lot to what his temperament would be as a person, the fact that he played violin, because then he has a propensity for precision or also not only precision, but also the aspect of working through this music in such a way that relates more than just pulling it off like the page, kind of like the things that we've been kind of going through here earlier in these past few slides. You know, these more ephemeral aspects of design beyond kind of the functional. He started off in a very early apprenticing underneath an inspector of public works. This also kind of gets into what defines Guastavino, which is an interesting character, and that coming along kind of in the middle and the late 1800s is a transition for the building trades and the architectural trades that we're going to get into here pretty heavily here today. But this kind of idea of inspector that goes out and inspects buildings, public buildings as at that time, but eventually private buildings as well, that he was kind of learning under, is something that was relatively new at the time. Then in 1861, he went off to school to learn to become what's referred to as a master of works. And this was a title that's given by completing your studies. You're seeing here a class picture from the class that he was enrolled with at this school. And this master of works is a type of trade profession where you learn the building arts, and it's a little bit different than the architectural profession where you learn architecture in a realm of not only building but also theory and history and these types of things. The building arts had been going on for centuries, for millennia, passed down through father to son in a lot of cases, or apprentice to master. And so this is the kind of hands-on type of experience that he was learning in the building arts. And this is having been a long tradition, this architectural tradition was something that was coming online in the 1800s into the 1900s that had not been prior. And the large part of this was coming out of Paris in the École des Beaux-Arts, where it was a tradition of learning to design and build on paper. Two-dimensional paper, plans, elevations, sections, as opposed to, in this case, a lot of times they'd be building with models in three-dimensional form. And so this is a photograph inside a violin, actually it's a cello, not a violin, but it's similar form. This is by an artist that recently has been taking these photographs inside instruments. And what's interesting about this is it gives you this, again, this interior sense of space for something you generally don't occupy inside of because it's kind of too small to get inside of. But what's fascinating between this and architecture is not only is this clearly is looking at a violin or a cello from an architectural perspective. This really has a sense of visual interior space here, a column supporting with these walls and the roof overhead. But what's also interesting is the entire space is defined by this curvilinear shape. You don't have any right angles here. It's one of the few objects that I know of that is completely curvilinear in all of its aspects. And not only in that regard, but also this idea of tension. All these pieces of wood here are in very high tension that's kind of created by the strings that are pulled tight in order to get the strings to have certain notes that they resonate on. But this tension that's built into the shape and the form is also something that's interesting because in the history of architecture, over the centuries, architecture has been primarily about compression and weight in compression and not in tension. And that's really what defines Guastavino that we're going to see with his tile vaults, is that he's exploring architecture in this idea of tension as opposed to compression. And so with Guastavino, these tile vaults that we're seeing overhead here on the ceiling, this idea of tiling vaults was something that can be traced back in its earliest forms to the 1300s. In particular, there was a king, King Peter IV in Valencia, the place that Guastavino grew up, that was writing to some of his masons down in Zaragoza to tell them about this structure that he learned of or came to know of. And they were doing some things here, the vaults, that had not been done before. And so this is the earliest written document, this letter that he wrote, that references this idea of these thin tile vaults that are considered Catalan or Spanish style vaults that this course is based on. I'm going to read a portion of this letter here. It says, the king says, "We have started the works at the Royal Palace of Valencia, and we have found a work of plaster and brick, very lightweight and of low cost. And for this reason, we ask you send one of the best experts so that they can see how this work is made and reproduce it here in a similar way." And so he's asking, you know, to send some of his workmen down to take a visit and see, because at the time that he was writing this letter, this was being built. And this was in 1382. But he wanted them to go down and see what they were doing with these tile vaults that had not been done prior, or at least he wasn't aware of prior. And this speaks to this idea of this master of work type education that Guastavino was getting, where a lot of the way that you build is based on this kind of trial and error, where you put something up and if it falls down, you try to do it a different way, and you keep doing that until it doesn't fall down. And over the centuries, you refine a way of building that seems to work. And so when you find someone that's varying and doing something else, that takes notice of the other builders. And especially if that thing that's going up, as in his words, is a lower weight, a lower cost form of building, or it's lightweight, so it has less material, which has its advantages. But more importantly, he wanted to send his masons down to see it firsthand and to see how they're building it, so he can come back and he can replicate that same technique in his palace that they were also building at the same time. So this particular technique, compared to stone vaulting, which was what was used prior, you can see the ribs here are in stone, and in between the ribs they're filling in with these thin clay tiles. But these this was, at the time, which is what brought about this letter, was seen as revolutionary by the builders. They really marveled at the economy of the material. The economy, not so much in cost, but the economy just in very little material needed to build these vaults, as compared to these massive stones that generally would be used in the vaults. The speed of the construction was much faster with these clay tiles, which we're going to get into a little bit. But also, just what was really fascinating was just the thinness. These clay tiles generally are about an inch thick. They roughly are around 4 to 6 inches wide by about 16 inches long, about an inch thick. And so a typical Catalan vault will be two layers, three layers, maximum four layers, but generally about two layers of 1 inches. So these vaults are literally about 2 inches thick, and they span these great distances and carry these enormous loads that are placed upon them, not only as a roof structure, but also when they're used as a floor structure and they have multiple floors atop. And so this economy of material thinness was miraculous to these builders that would witness this type of thing. And the two really kind of defining features of this thin tile vault is the one that the tiles are laid flat, and the other is that they're using this new kind of plaster material coming out of Paris, called plaster of Paris, surprisingly. And this type of plaster would set much faster than the lime plaster that they generally would use. And because it would set faster, they could work these tiles in much quicker, and they would set up, and so it would expedite the process much faster. Yes.
Was there a relationship with the same school that Gustavino went to with Gaudi?
Yeah, that's a great point. So the school that he attended, his Master of Works, many of the professors that were that taught there were legendary in their field, were the same professors that taught Antonio Gaudi when he attended the same school about a decade later. Interestingly enough, Gustavino started about a decade before Gaudi, but when Gaudi came in, they both finished roughly about the same time. So it took Gustavino a little bit longer. Gaudi then went on to study at this new school that just started in Barcelona for architecture, School of Architecture. They just started up. Gustavino went off to the same school. Gustavino didn't finish that school. He ended up dropping out, but Gaudi continued. And so Gaudi, by finishing that school, then received the certificate or the title of architect. Gustavino was only considered Master of Works from his first school, which Gaudi achieved as well. But he never got that architectural certification that Gaudi did. And that kind of, you'll see in about 2 weeks when we get, or actually next week when we talk about New York and Boston, when he came over to the United States, that had great implications, the fact that he didn't have that kind of architectural certification under his name. So we're seeing here a convent in Santo Domingo. This is actually down in the cellars. You can see here down below, we're seeing some vaulting here, bricks. This is in Zaragoza, which is the place that the Masons were working when the king wrote his letter. And this is kind of an example of the type of tile work or brick work that was happening at the time prior to this new kind of thin tile concept came along. And I point this out, this particular image here, because you can see the way the bricks are laid, this stepping that occurs to kind of create this span for this arched opening here. And this kind of stepping together of these tiles or these bricks is a method that is a way of fingering together or puzzling together the pieces that make up the structure. And this is a technique, or this puzzling together and fitting together is something that the Catalan builders and architects are very good at with brickwork. And so we see this very innovative and crafty way to approach it. And that's kind of what draws and leads to this development of this flat tile that we find later. This is an example of very traditional Catalan style or Spanish style wall partition, interior wall. You can see these thin bricks that are laid kind of vertically to make this interior partition. So this type of partition wouldn't be load-bearing. The floor up here is being bared by the exterior walls that are much thicker, but these interior partitions that are flat is really what is where the name for these flat vaults come from, is that they refer to them in the Spanish tongue or the Catalan tongue as these flat partitions. And it's this idea of the same way that they would lay up a partition end on end, they did the same thing but now in a horizontal position across the vaults. And we see here another structure from the same area. This precedes this flat style that they developed, but you can see here the bricks are laid on this way to where the ends are exposed as opposed to the flat portion where you see the face of the brick. And so they're infilling again between these stone ribs. They're infilling it with these bricks, which are much lighter, much less cost, much less expensive from a mason's perspective, with stonework, which is not only a more precious material but also much more labor to shape into place as compared to a brick. And so in this case, it's really a matter of economy, that they're infilling these vaults with a material that's less cost, much easier to work with, just to fill in the vault and kind of do the function, but not necessarily have kind of the grandeur that you would have of the stone, this type of stonework that's meant to be kind of shown off as a finished material. But nevertheless, this kind of striation of the brickwork is still quite visually stunning. And that this is where this new technique comes along, where instead of laying the bricks on end, they're laying them flat. And this is using even fewer bricks than laying them end to end, because as you lay them flat, they cover much more area with a single brick. And so the quantity of bricks is even reduced, in addition to the speed at which you lay them in. So it was initially started out as a way to cut corners, as a way to do something cheaper, quicker, faster, less work, less material, but then developed over time into something more than just that. So it's a little bit after 4 o'clock. I don't know if you wanted to take a 5 minute break or so, 10 minute break, and then we're gonna resume, or if you wanna keep on going through. We good?
Yeah.
All right. So this brings us to 1868. This was Guastavino's first significant project. This was a textile factory for the Battio brothers, who were in the textile industry making fabrics, and they were one of the largest textile manufacturers in the Barcelona region at the time, during the height in the mid 1800s, when the textiles in that region were world renowned. This is the same Battio family. If you're familiar with Antonio Gaudi, he did a house for the Battio family. This is the same brothers that hired Guastavino, and interestingly enough, Rafael, when he was growing up as a kid, he worked at times for his uncle, who was also in the textile industry, and he would work in his factory, and by doing so, he came to learn how the factory operated, how the job was done. And so this was a competition that he was awarded for this project. And so he had, through that experience working within a factory, knew how a factory operated, how it could be laid out, the design of the complex to have these advantages. And he really explored more than just the structure of the building architecturally, but he also got into some of these other elements that we'll go into. But you can see here, the compound is actually 4 blocks. This entire area here that was the project, four square area, just on the outskirts of Barcelona at the time, was growing and expanding through this industrial period in the mid to late 1800s, and so he designed each of these buildings, but most importantly is this, the factory floor here that we just saw the image of inside, is really what's most significant with this project. This is a exterior shot of one of those buildings on the compound, and you can see the brickwork that's also very stereotypical of Catalan style brick. Detailing that we get, that I'm sure you're familiar with in Gaudi's work as well, coming from the same tradition. This this project he was awarded at the age of 28, so he was quite young, not too long out of school, but it garnered quite a bit of exposure for him, reputation. Wanted to read a little passage here from one of the newspapers that was writing. They said, "The works of the grandiose factory that the Battio brothers are raising is proceeding very quickly under the expert direction of the master of works, Rafael Guastavino, who has knowledgeably presented the facades without excessive rendering, producing beautiful effect through the combination of stone masonry with brick. So we see some of that detailing they're referring to here, working through. Again, you see some of the stepping in the brick here that we saw from the earlier monastery photograph. This stepping out to kind of create projections horizontally to create a relief to the surface of the structure, to have more three-dimensional quality to it, creating shadow and light effects. But you also see the working in here of stone. So he's alternating kind of the brickwork and the stonework in layers. And this combination of materials together. Even though this kind of impressed the industrialists of the time, the locals were more impressed with this 200-foot tower that became this chimney for the factory that was down here at this level. That factory photo we saw before is kind of below grade. It's almost kind of in the cellar. But this idea of this tall tower chimney to exhaust the coal fumes that being Pittsburghers were familiar with, kind of that industrial era. This whole concept of getting that up in the air, kind of away from the people, that the workers down here at the ground level, was all about hygiene. It was about, you know, trying to create a healthier environment to work in, as opposed to kind of working in this air filled with coal and dust and soot. And so this hygiene aspect is something that he brought into his work. We're gonna explore a little bit of that as we go along here as well. But I wanna also read a letter that Guastavino wrote to the newspaper that wrote this article about him and his work, despite praising him for the success and how quickly he put this compound up. He built this entire, if you can imagine, he built this entire thing in 2 years, from design to construction and completion. So he was extremely efficient, fast, and clearly capable in the design of this thing. Here's the base of this chimney that comes down and flutes out at the bottom. But he wrote a letter in response. He said, "For some time, the local papers have attributed the direction of the factory of the Batlló brothers to me. This is inexact. In all buildings of this nature, there exist two thought processes represented by two distinct faculties whose attributions or limits were well defined. One represents the principle, the eminently useful that constitutes the design and direction of the factory. This corresponds to the engineer, to whom all subordinate for this type of building. The other represents the secondary, the design and direction that is purely and simply architectonic. The first part corresponds exclusively to my distinguished friend, Mr. Alejandro Mary. The second pertains to one who does not like to have his name published if it hurts others' feelings." And so he writes this letter to the newspaper because he was taking clearly a little bit of heat from his engineer friend that helped him with the construction. But this is a distinction that's significant with Guastavino's time. And this is what really this course is all about, is that during the late 1800s, mid-1800s, late 1800s, into the 1900s, we have this new class of profession that's coming online, these engineers and architects. Prior to this, it was the master of works, these builders, that would create these structures, all from know-how and knowledge and firsthand experience of construction. Now we have these people coming along, architects, engineers, inspectors, that are approaching it from a different perspective. In the case of an engineer, it's about mathematics and computation, trying to apply to the structures a more analytical approach to the way you analyze a structure, how its forces are all handled in a structural manner. But in this case, with the factory, the engineer he's referring to is the engineer that's engineering how the factory is going to be used, how it's going to work, how the workflow of all these various workers, which were about 2,500 people that worked at its peak in this facility, how they were all going to coordinate this functioning of the space. And so that layout of what buildings are what position, the factory floor, all that is designed and laid out by this engineer, as opposed to the master of works, Guastavino, who is just responsible for kind of the dressing up of the building on the exterior.
The circular building on the corner right, what is that? Keep going up a bit, yes.
I don't know specifically what that is. It kind of looks to just by the layout here, we have this structure coming here. The structure is just kind of demarking where these two come together. There's probably some type of more open function that's happening there, where it looks like it's got a raised vault and point. But I don't know specifically what that is. So the factory floor was interesting because he's creating this one large single space without division between this space. Quite excessive. It measures 330 feet by 260 feet. It was a single space that was 86,000 square feet. Factory floor. This is where kind of the work was done as far as creating these textiles. And in this case, you can see here in this photo, the shallow ceiling vaults, which are these Spanish vaults or Catalan vaults that we're talking about here with the thin brick. But what's interesting, and this type of vaulting, again, this goes back centuries, so it's not something that Guastavino created, or this vaulting system is not something that he innovated. And these types of vaults were used throughout this region for centuries to create floors and ceilings in structures. So this is not unusual. But what Guastavino brought to this that was unusual is this column, a metal column here that goes up and in this case supports a wood beam. And then the wood beam supports the brick that's spanning between the wood beams, the brick vaulting here, which then in this case is covered over with white plaster. So you don't see the brickwork because it's completely covered. And this is also a significant thing, like I was mentioning earlier, that back in Spain, the brick is considered a structural material. It's not a finished material. So they would generally plaster over that as the finish. We're also seeing it here, these horizontal tie bars. These are metal that are tied between them because like all vaults, when they're loaded from above, in this case, the roof, they tend to want to push laterally to the sides. That load is being transferred down the vault and it's pushing to the sides. So this tie bar is working in tension to counteract that horizontal thrust that you're getting in compression. And so it's this balancing of compression and tension is really what it's all about. But these steel columns, almost an endless grid of these columns through the space, was quite novel at the time. And this large open space was something that impressed his contemporaries. We also see some of the more formal buildings, the offices in the compound outside of the worker space. And you can see again, he's still using the columns coming up. He's got pendentive type arches that are coming together at a point with the vaults still infilling between these arches that are going in both directions. But it's interesting that, for example, this vault right here, all of that loading is being transferred to these four arches around the perimeter. And then those arches are transferring all their loads to these four points that the columns are holding up. So all of this loading that's happening in this entire surface is transferring to these four points down here on the ground. quite elegant. But at the same time, it's concentrating those loads, because this area here is much smaller, much smaller spaces. So those loads are compounding and getting increasingly heavier to what's considered a point load, to where now that load is all concentrated in a single point, which then needs to be handled as it transfers down and works its way to the ground. But that's quite that kind of acrobatics of transferring these loads through these vaults is where the complexity comes into play as these forms and shapes get more complex, which we're going to see over the coming weeks. And that really is the skill set that Guastavino brings, is his handling of those types of complex forms. He does almost intuitively. This is a shot on the roof of the work. This is the that field of columns that we saw. We're now up on top looking across here, and you can see on the roof that the roof kind of undulates to create these valleys where the rotter runs off and kind of is carried off of the roof structure. But then also at the top of the peaks, he has these openings that he's got brought into these places at the top of the vaults to bring not only light, but also air into the factory floor. So he's very concerned with the hygiene and fresh air, bringing this into the facility, natural light, even though it's this large open space. A lot of this this idea of health and well-being is something that was front of mind for him back during this time period. Then here you can see a shot of some of the workers inside some of these spaces. So this, at the age of 28, he gets this commission, builds this incredible structure within the span of about 2 years, clearly demonstrates to the public and to these industrialists that this guy is capable of pulling off these amazing things. So in this time period, he becomes sought out for quite a bit. A large part of the work also is kind of in the residential realm. This is a housing structure that he did, referred to as the Julia House. This was in 1874. This was about 4 years after he completed the factory. And this structure, the design of it on the exterior, is what is considered this Catalan kind of Art Nouveau or modernism that is coming online around this time period. A lot of what we see also in Gaudi's work, he kind of exemplifies this. But in the minds of these builders and these architects, it wasn't so much that they created or completed this program that was needed. They also wanted to kind of push it even further. They wanted to create kind of like a national identity of architecture, you know, in comparison to the French or the Italians that are creating these works of architecture and art that they're familiar with. They wanted to create a Catalan identity to their work. And so this kind of develops and blossoms into what's considered this Art Nouveau or modernism that's coming online at the end of the 1800s, which Guastavino was certainly considered one of these pioneers in this regard. This particular house in particular is quite interesting because he has, you can see here, a cross section through one of the floors. You can see that the top, the floor here is level for the upper floor, but you see the shallow vault supporting the ceiling for the lower floor. So this type of very shallow vaulting is a very common floor technique within this region, again, going back centuries. You see, again, the flat vaulting that was used in not only this house, but all of his house residential kind of commissions. He used the same type technique for the floors, the ceilings, and the roof. But in particular, he had developed for this particular house this concept that he referred to as a tubular system where he put into the inside the floor cavities, and that would transfer to the walls, hollow sections or hollow tubular sections through them that we kind of refer to, or we know of today, as these ducts for handling air and conditioning the air. He was putting these in into the walls and the ceilings to bring fresh air into the house. This was a novel idea at the time, similar to the factory, where just trying to bring in fresh air to the structure. And it goes back to this hygiene again. Or in his words, he said, to secure absolute absence of dampness, to remove impure air. Through this period of the 70s, 1870s, in 1873, he presented a house model for the Universal Expedition in Vienna as part of the Spanish delegates in the this Universal Exhibition. Then 1876, he also presented a series of photographs and drawings for house designs in Barcelona, through this exhibition that was being put on by his the school that he, Master of Works, that he graduated from. They were kind of highlighting some alumni work. He also was invited in 1876 for the Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia for celebrating the 100-year anniversary in the United States. He was selected by his Spanish contemporaries to submit photographs of his work in Barcelona and Valencia, to go to Philadelphia and display this work. And the work that he chose to send over there, most of it was his residential work that he was doing, in addition to the factory that we saw. But he was primarily drawing attention to these tubular chases through the walls and the ceilings to create this bringing fresh air into the structure. This hygiene and healthfulness was something that he was trying to articulate as significant, more so than even this tiling that we're really focusing on with the course.
Would those be oil lamps?
These here?
Yes.
I would assume so, yes.
So there would be a reservoir there that someone would fill periodically. They wouldn't have to be piping in gas or anything.
I would think so, yes. In addition to that, you're also off-gassing these fumes from these oil as they're burning. So, you know, all this stuff, as you can imagine, would all collect up in here, you know, kind of high point of the vault. So, you know, kind of like giving these passageways for this stuff to kind of exit. Is certainly something that he was trying to address.
They would be interesting to electrify, would they not?
Yeah, no, so that's something that's coming online, and we're actually going to get into that in 2 weeks as we get into the Chicago World's Fair, which is only about a decade and a half after this in Philadelphia, where they bring electric online, and we'll get into that point as we see in his work. So that brings us to probably the most significant project that he worked on over in Barcelona and Valencia before he came to the United States. And that's the La Masa Theater that we're seeing here. This is an original photograph. This was done in 1880. This was a commission that he received again by competition. Was awarded the commission for this design. And this was in a smaller town just outside of Barcelona, was creating this grand theater space. And we can see here the shallow vaults again around the perimeter of the arcade, that then is supporting this higher dome vault that we're seeing up above. And also in particular, you'll notice that the brickwork is not exposed. It's covered in plaster. In this case, the plaster is then decorated with a design around the perimeter here to add some visual appeal. This dome was recently restored in 2002. And they ended in the restoration, they ended up taking the plaster off and exposing the brick. The brick structure being a little bit more visually dynamic. In this case, they maintained the plaster around the perimeter on the vaults in the arcade around the perimeter of the dome. But by exposing this, you can see the flat brickwork of this Catalan style thin set vault that we're talking about. This dome spans 56 feet across. Again, it's made with two layers of brick, so it's only 2 inches thick across 56 feet. It's quite remarkable. The dome itself rises 10 feet vertically from its spring point here at the center. It's got an oculus at the center that's 13 feet wide. Here's another historical photograph. You can see again back when it was plastered with the ornamentation around the perimeter. But you can see in this case, they've got some banners that are kind of springing up from each one of these columns to the center oculus opening in the center here that, as you can tell from the photograph, is bringing a lot of natural light into the theater from the outside. You can see how much darker it is down here around the arcade. And so these, again, the loading of this dome is spread out to the perimeter here at the base. And as that load comes down, that's being transferred with each one of these vaults from this point to the ends of these vaults, and then brought down these, steel metal columns that he's supporting these. And so we're seeing the same detail that he used in the Bajio factory. The tile factory or textile factory. And significantly, what's interesting is by using these very slender metal columns that he can make slender because the metal is such a strong material structurally, is that he creates this effect where they're so slender that it almost kind of disappears visually around the perimeter. So he's not only creating the effect of where the dome almost kind of floats, it's almost suspended in the air magically. But the perimeter, much like in the factory that kind of seemed to go on endlessly with no kind of wall, he's kind of creating a similar effect here. But actually we see it in the last photo with the lighting effect. As the light comes in, because this you have the darker here, you don't see that back wall that's lit in this other photograph. And so you create, much like in the factory, this kind of like effect where this dome again is suspended in the air without any kind of supports below it. And so in converse to these mounds that we saw in eastern Ohio, where we had these walls without a roof, this is the inverse, where we have kind of a roof structure without the walls supporting it.
Makes me think of a tent.
Yes, exactly. It's much like a tent kind of structure. These iron columns that support the tent, and the tent also is an interesting point because a tent is also in tension. It's not in compression, and that's a shift that we're seeing in architecture even today, is that structures are no longer or they're shifting from a compression based to a tension based structures. And tents, as you mentioned. Another big proponent of that is, I'm drawing a blank on his name at the moment, but he built these giant geodesic domes, Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah, right.
Yes, thank you, Bucky. And so he talked about these tensile structures, and these tensile structures are dealing with creating physical occupiable architecture in a different approach. For you know, from the beginning of time, ever since structures were built, architects, builders have been wrestling with how you deal with gravity that's taking all this weight of this, all this material, and transferring that weight to the ground safely, so that way it doesn't collapse on you as you're inside these structures. And so that's a problem where you're dealing with compression. All this weight is in compression. Tensile structures like tents is solving that in a different way. And that's kind of this transition that's happening that we're seeing with these vaults. The vaults are a balance between the compression and the tension, and it's making this shift. And so Wasavino's work is in that regard also kind of like marking this transition point where the construction trades are making a transition to these tensile structures. There's a closer shot here. You can see the perimeter of these iron columns. And you can see the vaults, even the vaults are quite dynamic. This is what's considered just a single directional vault, where it just has one axis that spans. And then that comes down to a beam that's buried inside here, that's spanning from the wall out to this iron column at this point. So the loading is then transferred here as well as back inside the wall down. This vault here is picking up the perimeter band of this dome. And the other thing that's interesting with the dome is that even though the dome is in compression, all of this loading is coming down in compression. Again, if you recall back from the factory where we saw the tie rods that were running horizontally to resist that thrust that you're getting out to the side, the same thrust in the dome is happening in the 360, in all directions, we're getting this lateral thrust that's pushing out. And so to resist that, in addition to this, he ran an iron band around this perimeter all the way around to tie that together to keep that lateral thrust from spreading the dome out and causing the dome to collapse. And so that band that would happen at this point would tie into these iron columns coming down to bring those loads down.
Venting or ducts that you mentioned earlier, is that what those little points are underneath
the... These here? Yeah. I believe they are. Yeah, I don't know that for certain, but I think you're right. They're... Here's a close-up of the bricks, or the tiles. Again, these are 2 inches thick, two layers. We'll get into this in later lectures, but more of a constructionist, but it's a matter of kind of the two successive layers are kind of overlapped across the joints just to kind of create a little bit more strength.
Matthew, can you give me a detail of the particular tile? Are the edges tapered?
So the a standard tile is not tapered. It's completely orthogonal. Again, it's roughly 6 inches by 12 inches by an inch in dimension. These particular tiles that are used in this case as a dome, as you can imagine, it gets smaller as you work your way to the center. And so the edges of these, you could approach them in a couple different ways, is that you could use a standard orthogonal brick. And as you work your way in, the bricks get a little bit smaller, but the edges could still be parallel. And then you make up that difference with your grout that you're using, this plaster of Paris in this case. Or the bricks could be custom made to where they have a little bit of a taper to them, depending on the size. The taper becomes more significant as you get closer and tighter to the center. So the outer bricks might be a more standard brick. And then as they work their way in, they become a more customized brick for this particular application. But generally speaking, like in a simple vault that has a single direction, those are going to be a standard brick that's just going to be replicated. And that also kind of adds to the economy of this material, is that you don't need this custom piece that needs to be made, in this case, to fit into each one of these getting progressively smaller. The brick is like the standardized unit that can be replicated, manufactured very quickly and with great economy.
So it wouldn't be a wedge?
So In a single directional vault, it would not, it'd be like a standard brick without a wedge. In a situation like this, most likely I would surmise that, the tighter bricks inside would have a little bit of a wedge to them. But at the same time, when you have a less sophisticated manufacturer of these bricks, they, you know, these master of works that knew how to put these things together, they could manage with putting a vault up without having this kind of wedge shape. They could take a true orthogonal brick with edges that are parallel and still be able to replicate and create this type of a structure. And that's actually, as we'll see going along in the coming weeks, that's kind of an indicator when you look at the actual work, you can see details like that, what you're describing there, that speak to being able to date the bricks as far as, you know, how sophisticated the manufacturer was that was producing these bricks, making these bricks. We're gonna see as we go along here that Guastavino got to a point where he created his own factory to make his own bricks as opposed to sourcing them from other factories, because he wanted to control those types of details and those types of nuances to make his structures better. Yeah, that's a great question. Here we can see a cross section through the theater. And again, you can see this is the dome, very thin in profile for the span that it's creating this open space. You can see also the oculus in the center that's bringing in light and air into the space. And going back to the beginning here, the earthen enclosure, what's fascinating is you see, so the perimeter that we see here in this particular case in Eastern Ohio is this circular enclosure that, again, the archaeologists theorize what this was used for as like a gathering place or a place where functions might happen, you know, such a large place, maybe festivals or something related to the season. But it's all theorized. They don't know for certain. But what's interesting, like I was pointing out before, is that when you go there physically and you occupy the space, you don't know what these people that made this, what they were thinking at the time, but you know what they were feeling. Like when they were inside this space, they probably had a similar feeling that we have today as you occupy the space, where you have the sense of enclosure that's created by the walls around the perimeter. Also, what's interesting is that this mountain culture that created these earthworks, the vast majority of these mounds were something similar to what you find in the center of this space, where it's a very gradual kind of mound. It's the same type profile that we see in the very shallow vaults that we get in the Catalan style brickwork, as compared to like a Roman vault that's a true circular shape. Also of interest is that these mounds are being made of earth or clay, same material that Guastavino is working with in his tiles. So here we see them working with the same materials, creating a similar form, but obviously being done in for very different reasons. And in this case, like with the theater, again, you see that same profile that we saw in the mounds. And working with this clay. And in this case, with the theater, it's a great effect as far as creating this this dome that feels almost weightless, suspended up in the air on these very thin iron columns, which is the visual effect, and the effect that when you're occupying a space, you're gonna feel and perceive. This is the effect that Guastavino is trying to achieve in this particular type theater, for example, as what you would consider these things that an architect is wrestling with. You know, what's the sensation of the space that he's trying to create? I mean, this is something, if you're familiar with the French Gothic, this is something they're similar to trying to do with their cathedrals, where they're trying to create these spaces that, again, almost hover up in the air and come down on the most narrow, thinnest supports. to try for other reasons, but for the same visual effect that we see Blastavino doing with mixing the clay with the iron, in this case with the theater. So that wraps it up here for today. In coming next week, we'll be looking at him arriving in Boston and New York, and exploring some of the works that made his name in those locations, and then subsequently what brought him in then to Pittsburgh through his connections with Carnegie and some of the architects that were building for these industrialists that we're familiar with. But we'll also, through the Pittsburgh works over the coming weeks, we're going to break, if you'll notice in the syllabus, break them down into various attributes. The materiality, kind of the building science, the first week. We'll get into the structural in a subsequent week, the architectural. Each one of these things where Blastavino had these innovations that he brought to the building that he did through his tile work. So the tile work is more than just a functional or a structural element. We're going to see all these innovations that he brings through, and then in addition to that, we'll see examples of that here in Pittsburgh, where you can see those innovations in his tile work around the city. And then I also, if you notice in the syllabus, the back page, I've got a self-guided tour. I picked out about half dozen of these works, some of the best examples of some of these innovations that he's done, where you can take yourself out and go to these locations and see some of that work. But we'll be covering all of that in the lectures as we go forward. So, any other questions from today? Great. Well, again, I thank you for signing up for the class, and I look forward to presenting this stuff to you as we go forward.
Thank you.
Thanks.